Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as we tape this show, the Supreme Court is considering the case of Gill versus Whitford, deciding whether the way Wisconsin Republicans redrew voting districts in 2011 amounted to an aggressive partisan gerrymander. The case touches on nothing less than whether the U.S. can ever become the democracy so many hope for. We'll talk about it with Stephen Rosenfeld, journalist at Alternet and author of the forthcoming Inside Job, How American Elections Are Still Rigged Against Voters. Also on the show, when Donald Trump said that the biggest winners under his new tax plan, quote, will be the everyday American workers, as jobs start pouring into our country, as companies start competing for American labor, and as wages start going up at levels that you haven't seen in many years, close quote. You might have suspected he was lying because, well, his lips were moving. But some corporate media give credence to the idea that this GOP tax plan is one for the little guy. We'll talk taxes with Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. That's coming up, but first a look back at recent press. Quote, I have noticed that so many people like him are all alone and unknown, yet when they spill a little blood, the whole world knows who they are. A man who was known by no one is now known by everyone. His face splashed across every screen, his name across the lips of every person on the planet, all in the course of one day. Seems the more people you kill, the more you're in the limelight. Close quote. Those words are from a 2015 blog post of a young man named Chris Harper Mercer, describing a man named Vester Flanagan, who killed a reporter and photographer at a Virginia TV station, on air, days previously, before shooting himself. Harper Mercer went on to shoot 9 people to death at his community college in Oregon before shooting himself. Social scientists have long said of events like mass shootings that they are contagious and that media serve as carriers. Forensic psychologist Park Dietz told The Village Voice in 1999 that suicide, product tampering, and mass murder lent themselves to imitation, and the degree of imitation is connected to sustained and sensationalized media coverage. After the Sandy Hook school murders, sociologist Zeynep Tufekci offered some tentative media guidelines, noting that research finds, quote, establishing a path of action, a complete narrative in which you can visualize your steps and their effects, is important to enabling follow-through, close quote. Tufekci suggested that law enforcement should not release details of the methods and manner of the killings, and those who learn those details should not share them. In other words, no immediate stories about which guns exactly or how much RoboCop gear were used. And she said, quote, the killer should not be profiled extensively, at least not at first. We do not need to know which exact video games they played, what they wore, or what their favorite bands were, close quote. Which leads us, of course, to CNN's slow pans over the arsenal of the man who killed 59 people in Las Vegas October 1st, and the Washington Post headline about how the killer, quote, enjoyed gambling, country music, lived quiet life, close quote. The fact that the paper later changed the headline doesn't change the mindset that produced it, which is that when killers are white, they are first and foremost human beings whose violent acts are out of keeping, bizarre. Above all, no reason to look askance at those who happen to share their ethnicity or religion. There is naturally a need for reporting. Among other things, media could explore, as did the nation's George Zornick back in July, how the NRA has gone from a calm advocate for hunters to a primal outlet for hard-right paranoia. NRA head Wayne LaPierre, Zornick notes, quote, understands the gun rights movement as a culture war first and a battle over gun laws second, close quote. At the group's annual meeting, LaPierre declared, quote, it's up to us to speak up against the 3 most dangerous voices in America, academic elites, political elites, and media elites. These are America's greatest domestic threats, close quote. And, as the historian Zornick cites, Pamela Hogg has pointed out, the country has not always been that gun-happy. In the book The Gunning of America, Hogg writes, quote, The gun culture that exists today in America developed out of an unexceptional, perpetual quest for new and larger markets that had exceptional social consequences. The tragedy of American gun violence emerged from the banality of the American gun business. Close quote. Exploring such issues thoughtfully is not as easy as replaying footage of people screaming and running, but it's more likely to move us forward. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. We are definitely in challenging times, but it's useful to remember that it isn't that Americans, per se, are opposed to gun control, human rights for LGBTQ people, or affordable health care. At the same time, it's painful to remember why it appears that we are. It's because, as a recent piece by Neil Gabler for BillMoyers.com reminds us, we don't have a working democracy where every voice is heard. A minority of people have outsized power. One of the reasons for that is being considered right now in the Supreme Court. Recalled by many of us as an old-timey graphic in middle school textbooks, the term gerrymander refers to the drawing of political districts in such a way as to benefit a particular party. The case Gill versus Whitford is focused on Wisconsin, where in 2012, Republicans won just 48.6% of the statewide vote, but captured 60 out of 99 seats in the state assembly. Here to help us see what's going on and what's at stake is Steven Rosenfeld. He covers national political issues for Alternet, and he's author of a number of books, including the forthcoming Inside Job: How American Elections Are Still Rigged Against Voters. He joins us now by phone from San Francisco. Welcome to Counterspin, Steven Rosenfeld.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Wisconsin is asking the Supreme Court to overturn a decision striking down the 2011 redistricting plan for the lower house of their state assembly. Can you remind us what happened in Wisconsin that led to this being the test case for this issue?
What happened was the Republicans, after they got completely trounced by Obama in 2008, saw a way back from political wilderness, as the cliche goes. And they realized that if they won enough seats in state legislatures in 2010, that they could draw the maps that would last this decade. So Karl Rove wrote about this in the Wall Street Journal. The Democrats, from Nancy Pelosi to Obama, completely ignored it. And then the Republicans went out with some of the nastiest political ads you could ever imagine at the local level. And they just emptied these legislatures out of longtime citizen legislators. You know, they called women prostitutes, they called guys every kind of crook imaginable, and then they drew the maps. And what they did was they drew maps segregating the reliable voters, their parties and the Democrats. They looked at who came out and voted for John McCain in 2008, which was a lousy year, and they made sure that in these districts they would have at least 56%, sometimes not too much more than that, you know, reliable Republican majorities. And they put the Democrats, they packed them into other districts where they would typically win with 65, 70, 75% of the vote. So that's how you end up getting these Republican supermajorities, is how they control the U.S. House. It's how they control all these states that you think should be purple, like Wisconsin or Georgia or North Carolina, but instead they're firmly, firmly red. And it turns out that if you draw lines, political districts using race, it's illegal under federal law, with one exception, which is it's sort of affirmative action for minorities. But if you draw these lines using extreme partisanship, which is what the Republicans argued they did in Wisconsin, so far up in the Supreme Court, it's been legal. It has not been judged to be illegal. But Anthony Kennedy, in an earlier case, sort of hinted at, well, maybe we got to take a look at this because it's so unfair, and if you can come up with a formula for us to prove how unfair it is and how anti-democratic it is, we may consider it. Well, that is what the people in Wisconsin did. They came up with the formula. A lower federal court said, okay, we agree with you. The Republicans in Wisconsin said, we are going to appeal, and that's what brought us to the Supreme Court, where basically, you know, they're going to decide the rules that will either make our national politics fairer and more balanced, or continue being as extreme as they have been through the next decade, the decade of the 2020s, because redistricting is coming right around the corner.
Well, the way of measuring it that's been the sort of missing piece, that's the social science that Justice Roberts dismisses as sociological gobbledygook. He claimed during the arguing of this case that the intelligent man on the street would never understand how you could have a formula to figure out which votes were quote-unquote wasted.
Yeah, I should remind you that John Roberts also said before Donald Trump's election and campaign that we were in a post-racial society, and therefore we no longer needed the Voting Rights Act enforcement provisions. And then within 24 hours of that Supreme Court decision in 2013, virtually every red state in the old South passed voter ID laws. They got rid of same-day registration. They ended early voting. This is completely nuts.
Yeah, and you know, it seems so disingenuous in the extreme to say, as Roberts also did, that the problem of gerrymandering should be fixed through, he said, through democracy, you know, by which he meant the normal political process. But this is the normal political process.
Yes, this is democracy, and it's not very democratic.
Exactly.
In fact, this is what people really don't understand. This is one of the biggest, most influential factors on why Democrats and progressives have not been winning. The Supreme Court had a decision before Gorsuch was on it that basically threw out North Carolina's racially motivated U.S. House districts. And the numbers in it were the Republicans kept winning with 56% of the vote, and the Democrats in the few seats they held were like 69 and 70%. It's not democratic when you segregate voters. The language people use is politicians shouldn't choose their voters. But it's segregating voters, reliable voters, and it gives you a 6% head start. And then you have other things that academics have tracked. Strict voter ID peels off another 2 or 3%. And then pretty soon, Republicans have a starting line advantage before anybody knows who's running of 10%. And for you to win elections by more than 10%, I mean, maybe we'll see that in 2018, but gosh, it's so, so rare.
Well, this case, Gill versus Whitford, is talking about the Supreme Court's ability to shut down, you know, extreme cases, which we should note could theoretically be committed by either major party. But that's not really a system for going forward, it doesn't sound like.
Well, the Republicans in 2010, after they won political monopoly control in lots of states, they targeted a dozen states. And these are the states that are always among the finalists in presidential elections. We're talking about Virginia, North Carolina, Florida, Georgia, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, Texas. And it's as if we have two entirely different countries and two entirely different sets of voting rules. We have blue state, coastal America, where none of this stuff is happening. People almost don't understand how could this be happening. They can't relate to it in their experience. And then you have, you know, this red state set of rules. And the Democrats are no angels. They had plenty of things that they did to stop Bernie Sanders in that presidential nominating contest. I'm not sure he would have won, but they sure made it harder. The Democrats who run California are not exactly angels either. But nothing, they have done nothing on the level of a coordinated nationwide strategy to basically seize the House and seize these states. And they've done it, and it's held for every race, every election, every two-year cycle this decade. I mean, think of it. After 2010, the House Republicans have held it. And all those states that filed those lawsuits against everything, Obamacare, LGBT rights, affirmative action this, you know, climate change that, this is what's been the result. And actually, it goes worse than that, because when you have today in the House, things have been segregated to such an extreme amongst, you know, who votes, that you have the most extreme Republicans saying that, well, taking health care away for 20-something million people is not good enough. And Paul Ryan can't control them. this has created a downward spiral that's pulling us, you know, to the bottom.
Finally, we're recording this on October 5th. Do you have any thoughts right now about how Gill versus Whitford is likely to play out?
Yeah, I do. I suspect that they're not going to touch it, which means the status quo will hold. And the reason I say that is because Kennedy, who was the swing vote, said or signed on to a dissent in the North Carolina case that came out and threw out their congressional House seats last spring. And it was written by Alito, and it said that odious as all this extreme partisanship is, it's part of human nature and part of politics, and it just comes with the turf, and we just can't and shouldn't touch it. And I think that even though he was the one who invited the folks in Wisconsin to come up with a standard, that was several years ago, the most recent real clue we have from him is saying, well, I don't know, it just seems like it's just so much a part of human nature, and human nature is reflected in politics. We just got to live with the dark side. And I'm not optimistic.
We've been speaking with Stephen Rosenfeld, journalist at alternet.org and author of the forthcoming Inside Job, How American Elections Are Still Rigged Against Voters. Stephen Rosenfeld, thank you for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Well, thank you so much.
The key part of the Republican tax plan, CNBC explained, quote, isn't the individual or even the corporate tax rates. The big news is that it doubles the standard deduction and provides significant relief and simplicity for most taxpayers, close quote. And just to be clear, they added, quote, this should be the focus of the tax reform debate, not the endless old argument about benefits for the rich, close quote. A separate report noted that administration officials are abandoning their oft-voiced deficit concerns because of the amazing growth the plan will generate. What's a layperson to think? Here to help us understand is economist Dean Baker, co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He joins us now by phone from D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, to the extent that there is an endless old argument about benefits for the rich, it seems clear that the rich keep winning it. So is this doubling of the standard deduction, does that make the case that, contrary to all expectation, this is tax reform for the little guy?
No, and it's kind of incredible anyone really even try to pass that off, because coupling with doubling the standard deduction, they're eliminating the personal exemption. So the basic story, I should have the exact numbers, but the current standard deduction is roughly $6,000 and change. So they double it to $12,000 and change, and they're getting rid of the personal exemption, which is roughly $4,800. Now, that puts you up somewhat ahead, but there are two points to keep in mind. One is that the personal exemption increases with inflation. At least that's the current law. So 10 years from now, it'd be roughly 20% higher, it'd be roughly $6,000, basically putting you even. The other part of the story is that they're actually raising the tax rate. The bottom tax rate's currently 10%. They would raise it to 12%. Now, one of the things they haven't filled in is where all the rates would cut off, where exactly the brackets would be. But in any case, doubling the standard deduction is likely to mean very little for most people, which is part of the reason that most of the estimates show roughly 80% of the benefits going to the richest 1%. So I could understand the people in the richest 1% telling us not to pay attention, but that's a big deal.
CNBC, that same piece, says that it's about as far as you can get from tax plans that supposedly only favor the 1% or rely on trickle-down theories to boost the overall economy.
You know, the only thing I could say, if you want to be generous, is maybe they were confused and missed the part about eliminating the personal exemption, which would be kind of astounding. It's clear the bulk of the benefits are going to the richest 1%. You get rid of the estate tax, you lower the top tax bracket 39 to 35%. You have a special tax rate for pass-through income, like what Donald Trump gets his income through, just 25%. These are benefiting the rich and no one else.
I couldn't really think that any thinking person imagined that the plan would not benefit Trump himself. I would think his base would think he was a fool for making a plan that wouldn't benefit himself. You know, that's not the winner they voted for. Is there more to say about the part of the plan that CNBC says we should look away from, you know, what it does for the wealthy?
Well, you know, in terms of benefiting Trump, it is almost as though he designed a plan that would personally benefit him. I mean, I don't quite think that's the case. But, you know, again, I'd mentioned the estate tax, that it would get rid of that. Just to be clear, the estate tax applies to almost no one. It allows personal exemptions of $5 million. That means a couple gets to exempt $10 million. And that's roughly 0.2% of the states that get above $10 million. You have to be pretty well off. That's not just a successful small business person. He also proposes getting rid of the alternative minimum tax. And in the one tax reform that was leaked, or he released, however we got it, that became public, he was subject to the alternative minimum tax. This was put in place in the 86 tax reform, saying if you manage to reduce your tax liability by getting through all these other loopholes, you're going to have to at least pay 25% in the alternative minimum tax. Well, he gets rid of that. And then the pass-through business income basically makes zero sense. The notion of a pass-through corporation is the corporation itself pays zero tax. You just pass the profits on. I mean, to my view, that's kind of an outrage to begin with, because at least if they get protection as a corporation, limited liability, why shouldn't they pay tax? But in any case, we do that. So they pay zero tax, and then they pass it on to an individual, and you're taxed on it just like, you know, your wage income. It says ordinary income. What this says is, no, it doesn't matter what tax bracket you're in. So if you're in the highest tax bracket, if you're in the 39% bracket or 35 under their plan, you would still only pay tax at 25% rate because it came through a pass-through corporation. It's just kind of a head-scratcher. Why would you do that? And naturally, it would create a huge business and tax avoidance, because everyone, at least every wealthy person, is going to figure out how to have their income come through a pass-through corporation so they could have a 10 percentage point reduction in their tax rates. Not what you want to do with tax reform.
Well, a headline in the New York Times said, in Trump tax plan, a windfall for businesses large and small. Among the things that it indicates are an easy way to bring overseas profits back to the United States without being taxed. What am I missing about what's so great for the country at large to let corporations bring profits back without those profits being taxed?
Well, there's a couple issues here. First off, there's already roughly $2 trillion, I mean, we don't have an exact number, but somewhere in the order of $2 trillion in foreign profits of U.S. corporations that are stashed overseas, at least on paper. Those currently couldn't come back unless they were taxed. What they're proposing is to have some tax holiday. We did this in 2005, where it was brought back at a 5% tax rate, where they could bring it back and pay very little tax on it. So it says it's going to do that, but it doesn't say what the rate is. That's one of the things, I guess, to be decided later, kind of a big thing. But the other thing that's, of course, more consequence going forward is it shifts our tax to a territorial tax. And what that would mean is that corporations would only be taxed on their U.S. profits. Whatever they earn overseas, they'd pay zero U.S. tax on. Now, that's not particularly any boon to the U.S., but it gets worse because we don't know where corporations are actually getting their profits. So we've just given them a huge incentive to lie to us about where their profits are. And that's becoming increasingly easy because you have companies like Apple and Pfizer and others where much or all of their profit is associated with intellectual property claims. And we don't know where Apple's great innovation for the iPhone came from. So they're going to tell us it came in Ireland, where the tax rate's just 12.5%. And then they don't have to pay our tax rate. They'll just pay Ireland's tax rate. I have a hard time seeing why that's good for people in the United States.
Well, the plan, of course, is still evolving, but the New York Times says, quote, business leaders were nonetheless quick to applaud the broad outlines of the proposal, claiming that tax cuts would spur new investment and grow the economy, close quote. I wonder if I could ask you first what it actually means to grow the economy, and then does this plan do that?
Well, it's an improper use of the word grow, but that dates back to Bill Clinton, but, you know, whatever. It's supposed to be transitive, but make the economy grow, in other words, would be the way one would ordinarily say it, but that's, I guess, passé to use the correct grammar. But in any case, it would mean more rapid economic growth, but you're very hard-pressed to see how that would come from this plan. So the question is, would there be some spurt of investment? And a lot of research on this issue, the idea that you're going to get lower tax rates are going to lead to more investment. I can say it's going to lead to zero more investment, but certainly not any big flood of more investment. And the idea would have a measurable uptick in growth. That's really not a plausible story. So, you know, their claims, they're talking about increasing growth rate by a percentage point. They're just pulling numbers out of the air. There's literally nothing to support that.
Finally, I find the approach of a lot of coverage disconcerting, whether Trump Republicans will get a win after their loss on ACA repeal. But also coverage sort of separates and counterposes individuals and businesses and the economy at large, almost as if those were competing forces. But clearly, I can gain something as an individual, but lose it again and then some if the labor market is impacted, and then again if the broader economy is harmed in some way. Is there a better way to talk about tax policy?
Certainly, again, the wind stuff, the horse race stuff, there's a lot of that. And, you know, that's unfortunate. I mean, people want to read that, and that's okay, but that shouldn't be the dominant story. And unfortunately, it takes that form. But one of the things that you and I both have alluded to, it's not a complete plan, which is a little bit astounding, given that they were working on it for months, and they'd been talking about tax reform literally for years, that they throw this on the table. And in fact, the president's chief economic advisor, Kevin Hassett, criticized the analyses because they said, well, they're making analyses of partial plans. And he's right. But why are they putting a partial plan on the table? The other point, though, is, yes, you know, ultimately, at the end of the day, people want to know how this is going to affect their lives. And on the one hand, there's sort of the immediate impact. Okay, am I going to pay more in taxes? That's kind of hard to say at this point for most people. I mean, odds are for most people it won't mean much difference. It will for the rich and the very rich. The other part is, okay, let's carry through their logic. What would it mean? You know, you'd asked the question before about grow the economy. So what would that mean? What's a plausible story there? Well, the story they would like to tell is, okay, you'll have more growth. That will mean higher wages, more jobs. That's the story they would like to tell. There's really no plausible way of getting from here to there. And then if you add in, you go, okay, you're creating large deficits. I mean, they're denying this, and I'm not the big deficit hawk, but you are creating large deficits, and there's good reason to believe that the day after they pass this thing, they'll start screaming about deficits, and then they'll say, okay, we have to cut spending, and they're not going to be cutting the military. So what that means is they'll be cutting Medicare, Medicaid, maybe Social Security. Who knows what will be on the chopping block, but these are going to be programs that people depend on.
We've been speaking with Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. They're online at cepr.net, where you can also find Dean's blog, Beat the Press. Dean Baker, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. You can find out more about FAIR on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.